Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We always appreciate your time and attention and invite you to join our conversation on the exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Plastic is so common in our lives now, it's hard for even older people to remember a time without it, when we had things like glass milk bottles and radios in wood cabinets and toothpaste in metal tubes. Now it's plastic, plastic, and more plastic. Scientists fear the plastic trash that makes its way to the oceans could outweigh the fish by the middle of this century. Our guest this hour shares that fear. Will McCallum is the author of a very plainly titled book, How to Give Up Plastic, subtitled A Guide to Changing the World One Plastic Bottle at a Time. Will McCallum lives in the United Kingdom, where he works for Greenpeace UK as the head of oceans. That puts him at the heart of the anti-plastics movement, making the case against plastic to governments and companies, and obviously in this book to individuals. Will McCallum, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You mentioned in the book that you recently spent a month in Antarctica, and you saw plastic there too, you're telling us.
Yeah, last year I was lucky enough to go to the Antarctic to as part of our campaign to create the largest protected area on Earth in a place called the Weddell Sea, which is a phenomenal place. It's one of the world's last great wildernesses. It's the coldest sea on the planet. It's right at the bottom of the world. And when you're there, you feel so remote. You know, I remember going up at night to see the chief mate on board and looking at the radar and seeing that we were there with just one other ship in a sea of more than 2 million square kilometers. And yet when we were there, we were testing for microplastics, and we find microplastics in 90% of the water samples we took. We even had this experience where we came across this iceberg, you know, cathedral-like iceberg, many times larger than our ship, and we came round it, and there, just next to it, we could see these large plastic fishing buoys, bright pink, bright yellow. This is in one of the most remote corners of the planet, and it just had this sobering effect. You know, I've seen plastic all over. I spend time out on the ocean and on the coast working with fishermen, and I see plastic all the time, but I was so surprised that even in this absolute pristine wilderness, we've somehow managed to make our impact felt.
And as we have heard a couple times in recent months about the fact that it's also been found, plastic has been found at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, so at the bottom of the ocean, as deep as you can get on the planet.
Absolutely. Not only, you know, not just any piece of plastic, but a whole plastic bag was found 11 kilometers beneath the surface of the ocean in the Mariana Trench. And the fish down in the Mariana Trench, they've never come across sunlight, let alone humans, and yet they're swimming amongst our trash. It's unbelievable.
Wow, that's amazing when you frame it that way. How long ago, Will, did you personally begin making the change to a non-plastic, or at least a less plastic life?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely a less plastic life, and it's a big message in my book that giving up plastic altogether, not everyone can do it. You need either a lot of time or a lot of money, and that's why it's a case of doing what you can and also calling on decision makers to make it easier for you to do what you can. So I started, it's about six years ago, and it came about because I was traveling around the coast. I was spending a lot of time with fishing communities, working with them, and I just realized how much more plastic I was seeing compared to 10 years before. It just felt suddenly like it was really everywhere, and it was everyday items I was seeing. It wasn't, you know, fishing gear, which, like, it wasn't old nets or old fishing lines, which I think we've often seen on beaches. It was plastic bags, plastic bottles, bottle caps, cigarette butts, you know, stuff that we're using every day. And I thought, well, this is, you know, if I'm seeing it everywhere in a country that has got pretty good waste collection, pretty good recycling, it must really be getting absolutely everywhere.
You mentioned in the book that you do some sea kayaking, and you tend to run, too, along the waterways in any place you visit. So, I mean, you're seeing it all over the world, I gather.
Yeah, absolutely, all over the world. I mean, at the moment, I'm involved in an expedition from the Arctic to the Antarctic. Our ship, the Esperanza, is sailing across the world campaigning for a global ocean treaty so that we actually manage our global oceans better. And right now, the ship is in the Sargasso Sea, so near Bermuda, and we are finding plastic in huge quantities there. I spoke to one of the officers on board who said that they came across a huge patch of sargassum, the floating seaweed that you find there, and right in the middle of it was a bright blue plastic bucket. you know, this was he hadn't seen land for 8 days, mm-hmm. and there in the middle of the ocean was this bright blue symbol of human activity there.
Your focus in the book, How to Give Up Plastic, is single-use plastic. The term seems clear, but is there some nuance to it? I mean, how we define single-use versus other kinds of plastic?
No, so single-use is any item of plastic that you when you buy it, you then use it and then you throw it away. So the idea is, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, your laptop, which has probably got a plastic hard cover to it. I'm not talking about plastic garden chairs or things like that. I'm talking about, you know, plastic bottles, packaging. A lot of packaging is single-use plastic, or like I said, cigarette butts. But those are all the kinds of single-use plastic I'm talking about.
So we'll use an item once, and it'll be out of our hands in, you know, minutes to hours. How long will it linger on the planet?
Hundreds of years. Absolutely hundreds of years, maybe even longer. We don't know. It hasn't been around long enough to test this. But we think a plastic bottle could take up to 500 years. But then when it breaks down, it still remains plastic. It's just much smaller pieces of plastic. So they still stay in the environment as what we call microplastics, tiny little fragments, anything under 5 millimeters in length. And often you can only see them with a microscope. And we think about a third of plastic in the ocean by weight are these microplastics. And a lot of them are coming from the simple act of washing our clothes. So if you have clothes that are nylon or polyester, when you wash them, what we call microfibers, tiny little thin pieces of plastic, they shed off of your clothes and down the drain, eventually ending up in the ocean. And when they're there, they can be eaten by small fish, then eaten by bigger fish, and eventually maybe even end up back on your dinner plate.
Wow, that's a sobering thought. We'll talk about how we can reduce the microfibers and change our habits and how we do the laundry. There are many recommendations in the book, How to Give Up Plastic, A Guide to Changing the World, One Plastic Bottle at a Time. Will McCallum works for Greenpeace UK as the head of oceans. We'll come back and talk more with Will and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Will, I want to point out here that the book itself is not laminated, and the book, the paper's fairly pulpy, but you point out that a plastic-free binding glue apparently does not exist at this point.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the publisher, they were fantastic at sourcing sustainable materials, but, you know, it was evidence of just how much plastic we depend on. But, you know, I hope that the book isn't single use. I hope that it's being thumbed and well used as much as possible by people that use it.
Yeah, you want to see this book get really dog-eared by the time somebody decides to hand it off to someone else. Okay, chapter one, microbeads. How are these used?
And microbeads are, they were a funny one. They, in a way, they kick-started my campaign on plastic, and they did so. So they are tiny little beads made of plastic that are often used in face creams or exfoliators or sun cream and in some other kind of cosmetic makeups. And they were a really classic example of just simple lack of foresight. So a really obvious example of how someone had a great idea, you know, why don't we use this very cheap material to make our product nicer to use without thinking about what would happen if you designed a bead so small it could go down the drain of the sink. So where does that bead go? And they just didn't think about it. And there was a group of scientists in about 5 years ago who started looking at the number of microbeads in the Great Lakes in the States, and they found enormous quantity, you know, hundreds of thousands of them per test that they did. And that just kick-started a campaign in the States, and President Obama banned microbeads. And he did that at the end of 2015. And I remember looking at it and thinking, if Obama can do that over there, then we can definitely ban them over here in the UK. And since then, we've seen lots of countries across Europe and across the world banning microbeads. So they're a great success story of when a government actually suddenly clocked that they'd done something wrong. They'd allowed this product onto shelves without really thinking about it, and they just banned it.
So
gives me a lot of hope that we can do the same.
Okay, so hope certainly, but microbeads are something that you don't really see them because they're so small. We get into the larger items, though, that people can have less comfort doing without. An analysis of plastic on oceans and in beaches, what is most of it made up of?
So every year there's a survey, an international survey of the kinds of plastic that are most commonly found. And they are mainly household items, so plastic bags, plastic bottles and bottle caps. We see a lot of cigarette butts, so cigarette butts often made of plastic. And we see, you know, all kind of other household objects like cleansing wipes or cotton buds or menstrual pads. You know, we find all kinds of things like that all over the beaches. But they make up, you know, a significant chunk of plastic. But about a third of the plastic in the ocean is actually mainly this small, invisible kind. It's microplastics. And so much of that, as I was saying, it comes off of our clothes or it comes off of the rubber on car tires. And I think sometimes people wonder, well, does it make any difference? If you can't see it, is it really causing that much of a problem? But what happens to plastic when it goes into the ocean is it acts as a kind of magnet. So stuff sticks to it, bad stuff sticks to it. Things like mercury or cadmium, which are naturally occurring things in the ocean, but they stick to the plastic, which means when a fish eats that plastic, they're not just eating that microfiber, they're eating a whole load of toxins with it. And that's where we start to see a problem, because those toxins can accumulate and they can cause big problems as they go up the food chain. Things like preventing reproduction, lowering your immune system, things like that.
Well, here comes a question then from Val in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Will McCallum, the author of How to Give Up Plastic. Welcome, Val.
Thank you. I realize when the plastic molecules break down to an atomic level, there wouldn't be any danger to our DNA involvement. But on a molecular level, is there a possibility of any of the molecules of plastic getting involved in our DNA?
All right, into our bodies and really deep in there. Thanks for the question, Val.
You know what? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that one of the things we're calling for is for government to actually launch public health inquiry. Then they're not looking at what the potential health impacts are going to be. It's being left down to small groups of scientists with limited budgets. But if we're allowing this much plastic to go into the ocean and, as you say, break down and potentially end up back in our body, then we have to know what the public health consequences of that are.
Are there tests that indicate it's in our digestive tracts or bloodstreams?
Absolutely. Digestive tracts, bloodstream. You know, if it's in the water we drink and the salt we're sprinkling on our food, it's going inside of us. There's no doubt that we all have, or the majority of us have, some plastic in us. The research that needs to be done is, what impact is that having?
So let's talk about the ways in which we can start reducing our own usage here, because the things like the numbers on bottles are shocking. And again, the book is subtitled A Guide to Changing the World, One Plastic Bottle at a Time. How many are used every day just in the UK?
In the UK, we use about 35 million plastic bottles every single day. So the UK has a population of over 70 million. So that's every person using a plastic bottle every other day. And only half of those are recycled. So about half of them are, you know, ending up in landfill or maybe being swept into the ocean or being exported to another country to be dealt with. Plastic bottles are a major problem, and there's sort of no reason for them. You know, if you live in a country like the UK, like the US, with safe drinking water, do you really need to be drinking it out of a plastic water bottle? One company, Coca-Cola, they make 120 billion plastic bottles every single year. It's an astonishing number, and it's so pointless, so many of these plastic bottles. When, you know, drinks fountains, reusable water bottles, they could all help be part of a solution.
I'm trying to do the math in my head, and it's not coming quickly, but that's several bottles for every single person on the earth, man, woman, and child, over the course of a year. That's a lot of bottles. So talk about fine-tuning the message then, Will, because you're saying it's not enough to shame consumers. What else needs to happen here?
Yeah, so a big motivation for me getting involved with plastic was that I could see a lot of companies sort of saying, this is about irresponsible people littering. And yeah, sure, a part of the problem is that. But these companies are producing a lot of the stuff, and they're not paying the price. You know, they are... perfectly allowed to produce something, put it on the shelf, and then absolve all responsibility the moment a customer picks it up. And, you know, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen with the automobile industry. It doesn't happen with the electronics industry. Those are industries which are increasingly having to take responsibility for the end life of their products. And we think that the same should be the case for plastics. So that would, in my mind, reduce the amount that they're producing, because they won't want to produce so much of this stuff if they're having to take responsibility for it. So what I say to individuals is, you know, that piece of plastic in your hand, definitely reduce it where you can, because there's no guarantee it's not going to end up in the ocean. You know, the straw in your hand, the coffee cup in your hand, you don't have any control over it once you throw it in the trash. But more important, or as important, is that you amplify what you're doing. So you talk about it to your friends, colleagues, neighbors, on social media. You let people know that you know, these are the reasons you're giving up plastic, and hopefully they follow your example. And that's what will help send this message to companies and to politicians, that we don't want to be a part of this problem anymore, and they need to make it easier for us.
Will McCallum is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the head of oceans for Greenpeace UK. He's written a book called How to Give Up Plastic, A Guide to Changing the World One Plastic Bottle at a Time. We should point out it's also one room at a time. We go through the house room by room, and we'll have yet to have that discussion. We'll get there in a few minutes. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about plastics and what to do to keep them out of landfills, out of oceans, out of our lives. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. You back up to a logical question about plastic in the ocean. How does it get out there?
It's a good question, and it's the first question. I think a lot of people don't, particularly if you don't live near the sea, you don't necessarily realize that the plastic that's in your house might end up in the ocean. And there are a few ways. So I've already spoken about the microplastics that go down the drain and into the water system and flow out to the ocean that way. And that accounts for a lot of plastic, about a third of plastic by weight in the ocean. Maybe a fifth, we think, comes off of fishing, so discarded nets or lines, or maybe it's not discarded, it's just lost in bad weather or something like that. That accounts for maybe another 20%. And then the rest is from all different kinds of places, and it could be litter on a beach, or it could be that the landfill site that your plastic is being sent to is next to the ocean, and a bad storm or a big wave just ends up taking a load of it out into the ocean. Or it could be that there's a landfill site next to a river. You know, rivers carry stuff into the ocean. They carry our plastic into the ocean. So all of these different ways are ways that plastic is getting into the ocean. I think a lot of people don't realize that when you recycle, sometimes that plastic is being sent to other countries to deal with. And those countries, their waste systems are not necessarily great. We're flooding them with so much material, they're struggling to cope. So we did an investigation into a waste site in Malaysia. And on that waste site, we found chocolate bar wrappers, we found plastic envelopes, we found crisp packets, all from Germany, Spain, UK, US. You know, this was in a jungle in Malaysia. And it's been traveling halfway across the world. And then when it goes into the ocean from there, it can be carried anywhere by currents. So once it's in the ocean, it could sink to the seabed, or it could stay on the surface and be taken absolutely anywhere.
So they weren't shipped there. They floated there.
Yeah, often it can just float there. So in the Pacific, there's an island called Henderson Island. It's about as far away from land as you can get in the Pacific Ocean, right in the middle of the blue. And on that island, no humans have ever lived there, completely uninhabited. They think it might be the most polluted place on Earth with plastic because it's just taken there by the currents.
You do caution us in the book, Will, against pointing fingers at individual countries. Why?
Because of what sometimes the plastic in those individual countries has come from a totally different country. So it's, you know, if we look at Vietnam, which often gets pointed at and told, you know, they're one of the biggest problems. A lot of the waste in Vietnam will actually be coming from the US and the UK. It's been exported there for them to deal with, which means that their waste systems aren't dealing with their own plastic. Another reason not to point fingers is, who are the companies producing this stuff? They're the companies that are headquartered in European capital cities, in North American capital cities, Unilever, Coca-Cola, Nestle, famous, well-known companies. And they're producing this stuff in such quantities and putting it on the market in those places. So, you know, we live in a very international world, a world of international trade. So pointing the finger at a particular country when it comes to plastic, I don't think really works.
Well, and you point out in the book, too, a reminder here that the Philippines and other Asian countries get products in plastic sachets. What are those?
Sachets, I think a lot of people in North America, same as UK, we most encounter them with sauces, like in a cafe or something. You might have a ketchup or mayonnaise in a sachet. But increasingly, those sachets are being used to sell all kinds of things, so shampoo, soap, other sort of single-use products, and in order to sell them in tiny portions. And that's a real problem, because sachets, they're quite complicated materials. They're made of several different kinds of plastic that are melded together, and that makes them basically impossible to recycle. So if you go somewhere like the Philippines, you just see a lot of sachets in the rivers floating out into the ocean.
So what then becomes the alternative, particularly for people who don't have much money, if they're presented to them on the store shelves this way? What other ways can people obtain the things they need to get that are currently in those sachets?
So we're saying refillables and reusables. It sounds old-fashioned, but we did it for a very long time across the world. We used reusable packages that when you go to the store, you just refill it. Or, you know, increasingly home delivery is becoming a way that people receive their groceries. So, you know, when that home delivery drops off all your groceries, it's got a lot of space in the van, and it could take back all of your reusable packaging. So we need to start thinking of ways where we can cut it out completely or close the loop, so that, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you're refilling your containers and taking them back with you.
We have a phone message here from someone who chose to take some pressure to a particular supplier. Lori in Medford writes that she passes up bakery items at Costco because of their plastic usage. She feels leaving comments and not buying might compel them to change. Do companies respond to the pressure from consumers?
Absolutely. And so with all of my tips on how to give up plastic, I think it's really important to remember that one of the best things an individual can do is complain. Just, you know, let that company know that you don't want to take home their plastic. And they are listening. They're really listening at the moment. I know the plastic problem, it can feel a little bit overwhelming, a bit like, well, you know, this is such a huge problem. And I think for people who are maybe newer to environmental problems, it feels like, why aren't things moving faster? Why aren't things, you know, why aren't people taking action more? Whereas I guess I feel like I've been working on environment issues for more than 15 years, and I have never come across a problem that's risen in prominence as fast as plastic, that's seen so many companies wanting to take action, so many individuals wanting to take action. And that's because people are doing exactly what that listener said she's doing, you know, complaining, saying, I don't want to take home this plastic. If you put this product not in plastic wrapping, I might consider buying it. Very simple, but so often these businesses, especially smaller businesses, they've just not thought about it. So you can have quite a friendly conversation. And, you know, would you consider in this cafe not using plastic coffee stirrers? No one really needs them. And simple as that, you've had a big impact, much bigger than, you know, just not taking one yourself.
So aside from consumers taking action individually or collectively, are governments putting much pressure on producers to change their packaging?
They're not putting enough. They can always do more. There are some great stories. You know, the Seychelles have banned the import of all single-use plastic. But, you know, governments need to be working out what are the incentives and the disincentives to move producers away from single-use packaging. And there are a few ideas. Personally, I think it's really important they set a target. So they say, by this date, maybe 2025, we're going to reduce plastic production by 50%. Because I think unless you have that clear date in the foreground, there's no incentive to act quickly. And that's what we need. We do need quick action. So setting those ambitious targets with a timeline, you know, that's what any business would do if they were trying to achieve something big. They'd set a target and they'd set a timeline and an action plan. So governments need to be doing that. But another thing they can be doing is looking at, well, producers have got away with not paying their fair share of the plastic problem for a long time. So like I said, with the automobile industry, with electronics industries, they are responsible for their products at the end of their life. And the same should be true for for the plastics producers. You know, if they're producing it, they should be paying for it at the end of its life, paying for its responsible disposal. And you can bet then they'd start to be looking at, oh, maybe we shouldn't be producing so much of it in the first place.
We are talking with Will McCallum at Greenpeace UK about his book, How to Give Up Plastic, A Guide to Changing the World, One Plastic Bottle at a Time. Bottles all over the world, cigarette butts, microplastics, pieces torn off of larger chunks of plastics floating around the oceans around the world. About a third of the plastics in the ocean, as Will's told us a couple times, believed to be those microplastics. We'll talk about behavior room by room in the house, as written in the book, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us by phone and email. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. The book goes room to room in the house, and we will get there in just a second. But first, we have a call that wants to go to the farm. Brandon and Talent, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm an organic farmer. I've been farming for about 25 years, originally down in the Watsonville, Salinas area, where we primarily grew strawberries and raspberries, which are exclusively grown on ag plastic. I am terrified by what has evolved in the last year up here while our legislature was debating whether or not and how to ban single-use straws and whatnot. We have seen the proliferation in 1 year from less than there was 1,000 total acres under ag plastic in the state of Oregon. This year, we've now gone over 50,000 acres of ag plastic, very little of which will be recycled. We use ag plastic. It's an incredible tool in terms of what we use a tenth of the water. It reduces pathogens. With surface water, it's the only way to comply with food safety requirements. We haul ours down to be recycled in Salinas. It's one of the only facilities in the country that makes about 95% of those green shopping cart recycled plastic, shopping bags. Mm-hmm. They're getting into making new recycled ag plastic products out of it. But currently, the state of Oregon, there is nowhere to recycle ag plastic. And I find it a little ironic to suddenly be growing hemp with ag plastic. It's a 45-day crop, and this plastic's going to end up in our landfills for hundreds of years. In Salinas, they ended up, it's going to take a partnership, and it was a federal, state, and county grant partnering with industry to build this facility, and it's the only way it'll happen. It won't, currently, the price of oil is so low, new plastic will always be cheaper than recycling, so it requires a partnership. But there are solutions, and so it can be done. And in the meantime, biopolymers are close, but they're just not there yet. But in the meantime, we have to recycle it, and the legislature has to stop diddle-daddling. If they are going to promote hemp as a viable industry, and if they're going to allow the use of plastic for hemp, that plastic has to be recycled.
All right, Brandon, thanks so much for bringing this to the fore. It really did need to be mentioned. And Will, I can just add that with the legalization of hemp in America, that we've just had acreage explode, and it seems like every row of hemp is covered with these long strips of agricultural plastic that will not get recycled.
Wow. This feels like another one of those examples that they didn't foresee the problem. They just forgot to think about the end product life. But I completely agree with the caller. You know, this is one of those instances that needs industry, government, and the individuals using the stuff to come together and say, you know, we want this and we need it quickly. And that is it feels so obvious. And I all luck to him if you're involved in one of those initiatives and trying to get that started.
Yeah, Brandon, thanks again for bringing that to our attention. So let's now go room by room in the house, as the book does, How to Give Up Plastic. A bathroom has a few tough areas. I mean, can, for example, you buy toothpaste not in plastic, Will?
You can. You can get toothpaste in a glass jar. You can still get toothpaste in metal tubes. You can even, I've seen plenty of plastic-free bloggers deciding that they're going to make their own and put it in their containers at home. So you can totally get toothpaste without contributing to the plastic problem. And, beyond toothpaste, there are lots of companies now producing stuff in tins that they'll take it back, places like Lush or plenty of online places that will take your makeup or moisturizer and supply it in a tin that you can just return to them. But, you know, the solution I always like to just put out there for the bathroom that would reduce a lot of people's plastic consumption in the bathroom is just a bar of soap. It sounds so simple, but it's not that long ago that we didn't used to have endless plastic bottles of shower gel, of hand cream, of hand soap. So a bar of soap or multiple different kinds of bars of soap could be one of the big things that you do in the bathroom.
As you point out, toilet paper is paper, but it's wrapped in plastic. So, you can find some suppliers that provide it wrapped in paper, but you recommend some other ways too?
No, with toilet paper, I'd say find the suppliers that don't wrap it in plastic. There's not many other solutions to toilet paper. There are some companies. There's a company called Who Gives a Crap who will deliver to your door. And it's not wrapped in plastic, and I'm sure there are other companies out there as well.
Well, that was the part that made me wonder, though. I mean, are you potentially creating a greater carbon footprint because you're having stuff delivered to your door?
Potentially, yeah. And I think this is one of the things where thinking about the unintended consequences is definitely something I'd ask people to do. But I think generally being organized with your shopping, so that's something that I'm very keen to emphasize. It's one of the best ways you can reduce your plastic footprint is just by being a bit organized. So maybe after listening to this, maybe after reading my book where I include pages where you can write down your thoughts, but doing some of that research, where is there near you that sells this stuff without plastic packaging? Maybe there's a grocery store, maybe there's a market, maybe there's an online vendor, because yeah, doing a delivery just of toilet paper doesn't make that much sense. But, you know, doing a home delivery with all of your grocery shopping that where you've done the research to make sure none of it's wrapped in plastic, that's a pretty good thing.
So let's move from the bathroom to the bedroom. And here we get once again to our clothing and a huge source of plastics in the ocean, you point out. How do the microfibers get out there? And these are specifically from the artificial things like polyester?
Yeah. Polyester, nylon. So when our clothing is washed, the plastic kind of sheds off of it. So fleeces, you know, those woolly, those fluffy fleeces. They're a really bad example. Hundreds of thousands of microfibers could be going down the drain every single time you wash one of them. So there are a few solutions. I mean, the most simple again is: do you really need that item of clothing? Maybe you don't need it. Maybe you could just repair whatever it is you're replacing instead of getting a new thing. But you know, I play a lot of sport. I do a lot of outdoor activities, and I wear synthetic materials all the time. So how you wash them can make a big difference. Doing them on a full load, lower temperature, lower spin cycle, those are all ways you could stop so many microfibers running off and going down the drain.
Well, that's interesting. So if you have a choice of one spin cycle or two, take the one?
Exactly.
All right, and there are devices you can buy to put your synthetic fabrics into bags for the washer.
Yeah, there are bags called Guppy Friends, you know, and they're made with very very fine mesh, so they'll capture a lot of the microfibers. You've still got the microfibers to dispose of those, so you're still just putting them in the trash. They're not doing away with the problem, but they'll hopefully allow you to dispose of them more responsibly.
Let us move on to the kitchen. Is this the toughest nut in the house to crack?
It is and it isn't, because the solutions in the kitchen go back to that idea of being a bit organized. So if you do your research, if you find those plastic-free options, your kitchen can become plastic-free quite quickly. And if you're not finding those options, you know, doing what the caller who spoke to Costco earlier, doing what she suggested, letting the company know that you know, you really want this stuff to be plastic-free, and then maybe they'll supply it to you. So by making a shopping list, by being organized, by knowing where you're going to do your shopping, those are all great ways to reduce plastic. Or maybe it's buying in bulk. Maybe it's getting larger bags of rice or pasta or whatever it is and putting dispensing them into smaller quantities in glass jars. For your washing up, getting a glass dispenser, again buying in bulk and dispensing washing up liquid into that. Or, you know, in the kitchen, the other thing, I guess the move I made in my own life to reduce plastic the most was just making my lunch for the week on a Sunday and taking it in a lunchbox to work. And that, again, it just massively reduces your plastic footprint, but also gives you a much better experience eating healthier food, taking the time to sit down and eat your lunch, and saving you money at the same time.
Are you speaking of the Costco strategy that Lori in Medford recommended? Peter, no town given, weighed in on that as well, and he said he's done the whole complaint thing before, and the only way they'll listen is if complaints go to corporate. So he's recommending going over the heads of the people in the local store, or just complaining to the corporate. And these kinds of complaints have been heard. You mentioned an entire UK grocery chain that is going plastic free. Will?
Yeah, going plastic free by 2023. And that is as a direct result of them feeling this is what customers want. This is what customers are asking for. And, you know, not every grocery store can go completely plastic free, but I'm pretty sure most of them can cut it by 50% within just a few years. It's not that hard because there is so much plastic that's just pointless. There's so much that we don't need. It's just ended up on our shelves because companies wanted to find a different way to brand their product, or a different kind of plastic was designed and they thought they'd try it out. There's so much stuff there that we don't need, and that is what we have to start with, cutting all of that stuff out.
Yeah, speaking of different branding for products, there's a part of the book in the kitchen section where you talk about cauliflower steaks. What is that?
Thin steaks of cauliflower, so cauliflower just cut up into slices, that they were selling wrapped in three layers of plastic. So a customer took a picture of it, put it on Twitter, tagged the grocery store, and within 24 hours, such a Twitter storm kicked up that they discontinued the product. So it was a really great example of how that individual action, you know, one person being annoyed at this product, managed to change a whole corporate policy. And social media is great for that because, like the other listener said, it allows you to go over the head of the people in the shop. It's not their fault. And social media gives us greater access than ever before to the decision makers at the top.
We had a question yesterday about film-type plastics. You know, for example, you buy meat and fish, you're generally going to get those sorts of plastics. What do you do with those? Or how do you avoid getting them in the first place?
At the moment, there might be some areas where you could avoid getting them. So plenty of markets will be selling all of their stuff in non-plastic films. So there are probably shops that are doing without them. But with plastic films, that thin kind of cellophane-type plastic, you know, maybe there will be some uses for plastic in the future. Maybe that's going to be one of them. But the fact that we can't find a solution for that right now shouldn't stop us from moving ahead at speed with reducing all of the plastic that we do know how to get rid of.
A question via email from Becca in Lane County, who asks, when disposing of unrecyclable plastic, is it better to reattach the tops to the containers to keep the plastic object bigger, or should I throw away the unrecyclable container and tops separately?
If they're unrecyclable, in all honesty, it doesn't make that much of a difference. They're going to the same place. So I would say, you know, for the sake of maybe wildlife that will get trapped inside, I normally crumple up a plastic bottle and then put the cap back on to reduce the air in it. But it doesn't make that much difference, unfortunately. We have to see an end to unrecyclable. It's bizarre that in modern day and age, you're still allowed to buy a product that there is no way possible of disposing of it responsibly.
Well, you know, as we get to the chapter in the book about the kitchen but specifically the section on drinks, I mean, I find myself thinking that this is where a lot of our stuff comes from. I mean, the plastic water bottles, the plastic straws, the plastic lids for the paper cups. You point out even some of the cup linings, right? Even the cups that appear to be paper are lined with plastic.
Yeah. So in the UK, only one in every 400 coffee cups is actually recycled because of exactly this. The lining of the cup is plastic. So, you know, the products need to be made more simply. You know, companies should only be using a couple of different kinds of plastic, and government needs to legislate. It needs to make this pre-competitive. It needs to say to companies, you know, you can only use these kinds of plastic in these kinds of ways, in these kinds of designs, because that way the recycling infrastructure might actually catch up. If we simplified design and if we simplified the different configurations of plastic, disposing of it responsibly would be a lot easier.
Do you think the message is getting out fast enough, I guess? I mean, the message is getting out there. That appears to be the case. So that's why there are books like yours on the market. But is it getting out there fast enough in time to be able to start pulling back some of the plastic that's already out there?
Well, plastic production is set to quadruple by 2050. So, you know, we have a big old journey on our way to stop that from happening. And I do think that awareness is rising at an unprecedented rate. But I don't think government is acting quick enough, no. I don't think that the actions they're taking are ambitious enough. And that's why I wrote the book, is because I want to get more people involved. I want to get more people excited both about giving up plastic, but also about, you know, what they can achieve with their voice that, that they have, with their access to, you know, their networks. What can you achieve as an activist? And that does excite me, and I do think that that is rising so quickly, and it's an exciting time to be working on the environment.
Indeed it is. And Will McCallum works for Greenpeace UK as the head of oceans. He obviously lives in the United Kingdom. His book is called How to Give Up Plastic, A Guide to Changing the World, One Plastic Bottle at a Time. Will, thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Take care. That will do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Check us out on Facebook and on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. In the morning, the program is followed by The Takeaway. In the evening, our rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. The Exchange is produced by John Baxter, April Ehrlich, and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I appreciate you listening. I'd like you to join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.